headlines, China says it is firmly against U.S. unilateral sanctions against Iran as Tehran and Beijing begin implementing a major agreement. No let-up in tensions between Russia and the West. Moscow rejects U.S. allegations that it is seeking a false flag operation to invade Ukraine. And Japan's Okinawa Prefecture logs record daily COVID infections, with officials blaming the U.S. military stationed there for the surge. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. China once again voices its firm opposition to unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States against Iran. Foreign Minister Wang Yi says the U.S. is using its sanctions and political manipulation to interfere in Iran's internal affairs. Wang voices support for the ongoing efforts in Vienna to restore the 2015 deal from which the U.S. withdrew and reimposed sanctions on Iran. He says the U.S. is primarily responsible for all the troubles around the tattered agreement. The top Chinese diplomat made the comments as he hosted his Iranian counterpart, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, in the city of Wuxi on Friday.
This is the first time Hossein Amir Abdullahian is visiting China as Iran's foreign minister. The one-day trip came upon an invitation by his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi. The visit marked the beginning of the implementation of the much-anticipated Sino-Iranian pact known as the 25-year strategic partnership.
In this trip, we agreed to start implementing the 25-year Comprehensive Strategic Cooperation Agreement. I also delivered a written message from our president to his Chinese counterpart, Mr. Xi, to implement the agreement.
The Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership was announced in a joint statement during a visit by Chinese President Xi Jinping to Iran in 2016. In 2020, Wang Yi and then-Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif signed the pact in Tehran. So far, no detailed information has been revealed from the agreement, but the two sides say it covers economic, political, and security areas.
During today's meeting, we talked about industrial, scientific, technological, and economic areas, as well as tourism and other subjects that are covered by the 25-year agreement.
During the talks, China also reiterated its support for Iran's nuclear rights in the ongoing Vienna talks, aimed at removing U.S. sanctions, which Washington reinstated against Iran in 2018 after it unilaterally left the 2015 deal. As signatories to the accord, China and Russia both urge Washington to remove the sanctions as the only path to rejoin the deal.
Today, we extensively discussed the Vienna talks over the removal of U.S. sanctions on Iran. China's representative in Vienna, along with his Russian counterpart, plays a positive part in advocating Iran's nuclear rights and the removal of the anti-Iran sanctions.
China is Iran's number one trade partner. This partnership heavily relies on Iran's oil supply to energy-hungry China. Reports show that in 2021, and despite U.S. oil embargoes on Iran, China tripled its oil imports from Iran. Now the implementation of the new pact will guarantee the flow of Iran's oil to China and cement the two sides' trade ties. It goes without saying that China and Iran are strategic partners in every sense. And the top Iranian diplomat's trip is a sign that Tehran is determined to keep that path with Beijing. The two sides are expected to engage even more as the 25-year strategic partnership has moved from paper to practice. Yusuf Jalali from the Chinese city of Wuxi.
Moving on, Iran says the United States' cruel and unilateral sanctions are to blame for the suspension of its voting rights in the United Nations General Assembly. Iran's UN ambassador, Majid Taghlavanchi, says Iran is facing difficulties to pay its UN membership fee for the second straight year due to the sanctions. Taghlavanchi says the restrictions are not just impeding Iran's access to humanitarian items, medicine and medical equipment, but also impedes UN's work. The envoy said Iran is working to find a safe financial channel to pay its UN membership fee and reclaim its voting rights. Tensions remain high between Russia and the U.S. over Ukraine. Washington again accuses Moscow of seeking a pretext to invade its neighbor, an allegation Russia vehemently denies. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says the allegations are unsubstantiated and not backed by evidence. On Friday, the U.S. said Russia has already prepositioned a group of operatives to conduct a false flag operation in eastern Ukraine to lay the groundwork for invasion. For weeks now, the U.S. and Western military alliance NATO have been accusing Russia of intending to attack Ukraine. That has raised tensions with Moscow, which is unhappy with increased military activity by NATO near its borders. Russia says NATO expansion further east threatens the country's security. Scott Bennett, a former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer, says the West is resorting to every pretext to accuse Russia of planning to invade Ukraine.
It is the West, specifically the United States and the Biden administration and their over-aggressive military that has fabricated this fantasy. And they are really reflecting their own agenda, their own ambition, their own intent. There will be a false flag event, but it won't be orchestrated by Russia. It'll be orchestrated by the West, most likely the United States, Britain, and Israel, to try and create a flashpoint. And Russia has said this weeks and weeks ago that they had picked up this intelligence. So the West is sort of behind the eight ball. They are scattered. They are disorganized. Their diplomatic objectives and abilities are completely scatterbrained and tattered, very much reflective of Joe Biden's scatterbrained dementia and confusion. So they're trying their best to throw up as much smoke and confusion and distraction as they can against Russia, in the hopes that somehow Russia is going to grow fatigued or be intimidated and hesitant. And I think that is a tragic miscalculation of the Russian temperament, mind, and political stance at this point.
Moving on, Russian soldiers are flying back home from Kazakhstan, where they helped restore calm following days of unprecedented protests. The withdrawal is expected to be completed by Wednesday. The Russian forces are part of a military alliance of ex-Soviet states that were sent to the Central Asian country on a peacekeeping operation. The sudden increase of fuel prices sparked public protests in Kazakhstan. The rallies spiraled out of control and quickly turned bloody. President Kasym Tokayev asked for urgent assistance from the Russian-led bloc to contain what he called foreign-sponsored terrorism. During the 10-day unrest, nearly 10,000 people were arrested and dozens killed, including protesters and police. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has addressed both Russian and foreign journalists in his annual press conference in Moscow. He touched upon several issues, including the developments in Kazakhstan and the growing tensions with the West near Ukraine. Here's a report.
At a press conference in Moscow, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov touched not only on negotiations with the West, but also the peacekeeping operation in Kazakhstan and the upcoming meeting of the presidents of Iran and Russia.
The visit, in short, is very important. It's time to resume contacts at the highest level, which are traditionally close and regular among us, and which also fell victim to the coronavirus infection. The significance of the visit, first of all, is the need to take an inventory of our entire agenda, taking into account considering the new government in Iran.
Lavrov added that Moscow is in favor of holding a conference on security in the Persian Gulf, where it would be possible to discuss the claims accumulated both by Iran against its Arab neighbors and by its Arab neighbors against the Islamic Republic.
Such forum can unite Iranians and Arabs. Each of the parties would put their concerns on the table. They would also talk about their concerns over Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and other volatile areas that somehow cause controversy between other countries.
Regarding relations with the West, Russia has come up with offers of security guarantees as its patience has run out. Moscow is waiting for the West to give a concrete and written answer to its initiative and is not going to wait indefinitely. Last month, Russia's foreign ministry published draft security proposals between Moscow and Washington on ensuring the security of Russia and NATO member states. Consultations on these issues were held on January 10th in Geneva, a session of the NATO-Russia Council was held on January 12th in Brussels, and a meeting of the OSCE Permanent Council took place on January 13th in Vienna.
The appearance of NATO on the Russian borders is categorically unacceptable. This is a real red line. The appearance of U.S. weapons and military bases there on the Sea of Azov is the second red line. It simply reflects the West's overreach, and to put it bluntly, in violation of all obligations, in violation of common sense.
Lavrov said NATO had come ever closer to Russia's borders during five waves of expansion starting 1997, when it formalized its relations with NATO. The diplomat said it absolutely cannot suit Russia when it is required to send troops to barracks on its territory, while at the same time the Americans, the Canadians and the British are building bases in Ukraine and the Black Sea region.
Russia's efforts to strengthen ties with its neighbors demonstrate differences between the CSTO and NATO. Russia and its allies leave countries at the end of military missions, thus establishing strategic partnerships. And regarding unfriendly policies adopted by Western governments towards Russia, Moscow advocates for constructive dialogue and mutual respect. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
A new attack on U.S.-led foreign forces based in Iraq, this time in Salahuddin province north of the capital, Baghdad. Iraqi media quoting security officials say a drone attack hit a Balad air base housing U.S.-led forces. The attack caused fire in some parts of the base, but the extent of the damage is not clear yet. Still, no claim of responsibility. And all that is the latest in attacks targeting American forces and their bases in Iraq in recent weeks. On Thursday, three Katyusha rockets hit the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad's fortified Green Zone. All these are happening at a time when the U.S. is facing growing calls in Iraq to leave. Those calls began after U.S. assassinated top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and a senior Iraqi commander in January 2020. New York police arrests demonstrators holding a sit-in to demand government protection for tenants. The protesters called for the extension of the state's eviction moratorium, which is set to expire on January 15th amid rising coronavirus cases. The expiration ends a critical economic support put in place at the start of the coronavirus pandemic. It sets the stage for a possible rush by landlords to try to evict low-income renters. Organizers are pushing for new laws to be passed for greater protection for the moratorium to be extended until June. The U.S. military stationed in Japan faces criticism over its COVID response. That comes as Okinawa Prefecture, hosting American forces, logs record daily infections fueled by Omicron. Okinawa recorded over 1,800 new cases on Saturday. The governor there has expressed anger over what he called inadequate disease controls at U.S. bases. He says that they allowed Omicron to spread in public. Japan stepped up measures, including restrictions on foreign travels in three regions in November. But the U.S. military kept moving its personnel in and out of the country under a separate testing and quarantine pretext. Okinawa hosts 70% of the U.S. facilities. In August 2020, an explosive spread of infections connected to an outbreak among Americans prompted the prefecture to declare a state of emergency. The outbreak then intensified the already strained tensions between locals and American forces. Now, North Korea confirms test firing two tactical guided missiles amid growing tensions on the Korean Peninsula. Pyongyang says the railway-borne projectiles hit their designated targets in the East Sea. It said that the test launches were aimed at checking the proficiency of the railway-borne regiment, which first was tested back in September. North Korea also tested two hypersonic missiles last week. They triggered new U.S. sanctions on people involved in its ballistic weapons program. Washington says the missile tests are a threat to regional security, but Pyongyang says its tests are self-defense and amid U.S.'s hostile policies and joint military drills with South Korea.
The U.S. levied sanctions on six North Korean officials and two organizations following Washington's rebukes of Pyongyang at the United Nations. North Korea conducted several ballistic missile tests over the past week, including two Friday afternoon. But North Korea's ally China believes the sanctions raise tension. Since sanctions began 15 years ago, North Korea has developed a credible nuclear threat. Pyongyang argues that it has a right to self-defense in the face of U.S. hostility, which includes military exercises of the 28,500 U.S. troops in South Korea. The U.S.-led UN Security Council sanctions against North Korea seek to encourage Pyongyang to negotiate denuclearization.
The UN Security Council sanctions against North Korea are being carried out mainly by the US and Japan, along with several other countries. Hence, if the US and Japan truly seek the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, they should stop sanctions and conduct dialogue and diplomacy with North Korea.
South Korea also favors sanctions relief for North Korea, with its unification ministry Friday vowing to continue efforts at providing humanitarian aid. South Korea has also called for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War, although the U.S. has shown little interest. South Korean President Moon Jae-in has made repeated attempts to bring the U.S. and North Korea together for a meaningful dialogue. But with Moon's term set to expire this May, this last round of U.S. sanctions will likely deal a final blow to President Moon's peace-building efforts. Frank Smith, Seoul.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Jesus never hesitated to fight against evil and call people to piety. January the 3rd, 1994. Jesus Christ was equipped with the power of performing miracles and carried a divine message for humanity which saved them from the darkness of polytheism, atheism, ignorance and oppression and guided them towards justice, knowledge and worshipping God. He never hesitated to fight evil and call people to piety throughout his life. And this is the lesson which all Christians and Muslims who believe in the prophethood of Jesus Christ should learn. Today, humanity is in need of these teachings more than ever before. And Islam, which is a complement to real Christianity, has put calling humanity to piety and moral perfection high on its priority list. Making use of the great powers of nature through their God-given knowledge, misguided humans tend to tread a different path, and this makes the duty of the followers of divine faiths even heavier. The domineering powers and governments of the world have made life difficult for nations and individuals and do not refrain from inflicting any type of oppression on them. They do those things in the name of Christianity. These powers are, in fact, totally unaware of the teachings of Jesus Christ.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Saint Mary is a role model for believers. August 7th, 2004. At the opposite end of the scale, Allah the Exalted mentions two women as role models for believers. And Allah sets forth as an example to those who believe the wife of Pharaoh. Behold, she said, O my Lord, build for me in nearness to you a mansion in the garden, and save me from the Pharaoh and his doings. The Holy Quran, Surah 66, verse 11. One was the wife of the Pharaoh, and the other was Hazrat Maryam, and Maryam the daughter of Imran. The Holy Quran, Surah 66, verse 12. As for the first woman, she was not beguiled by the Pharaoh's palace. She was a woman who was raised in a Pharaoh-like manner, and most probably her parents and household members were the descendants of the same Taghuts. She was living with utmost comfort and welfare, but faith in Musa conquered her heart, and as a result, she believed in him. When she began to believe and know the path, she abandoned all the comfort and welfare, and she was no more attracted to that great palace. She said, O my Lord, build for me, in nearness to you, a mansion in the garden. She preferred a house in paradise, and she attached no significance to the material life. As for Hazrat Maryam, and Maryam the daughter of Imran, who guarded her chastity, and we breathed into her body of our spirit. She preserved her chastity. These are human values.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all Allah, I want to thank you. I want
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
In early January, South Africa bade farewell to Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the last great hero of the struggle against apartheid. Tutu opposed the evils of racism, oppression, intolerance, and injustice, not just during the apartheid era in South Africa, but wherever in the world he saw moral wrongs. This is how South African President described the late Archbishop Tutu during his funeral ceremony.
A humble and brave human being who spoke for the oppressed, the downtrodden, and the suffering of the world.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who passed away last December. He was the last in a generation of great heroes who struggled against the apartheid regime in South Africa. Internationally, he was a renowned supporter of the Palestinian struggle against the Israeli apartheid regime. In the second part of our program, we shall talk about the postponement of Libyan presidential election that was supposed to take place last December. We are asking, what are the local and international factors behind this postponement? So stay tuned as our experts give us their insight.
Tribute to Archbishop Tutu. On the first day of the year 2022, South Africa held a state funeral for Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the last great hero of the struggle against apartheid. Tutu died on the 26th of December, aged 90, triggering grief at home and across the world for a life spent fighting injustice. In 1984, Tutu won the Nobel Peace Prize for his struggle to end white minority rule on South Africa. That year, he traveled to the United States, where he condemned the Reagan administration's support for the apartheid regime in South Africa.
Apartheid is as evil, as immoral, as unchristian in my view, as Nazism. And in my view, the Reagan administration's support and collaboration with it is equally immoral, evil, and totally unchristian without remainder.
The late Archbishop Tutu will be remembered as a defender of Palestinian rights and a harsh critic of Israeli occupation and apartheid. He also backed international campaigns to boycott the brutal Israeli regime. Here is one of his statements in support of Palestine.
Critical mass of people want to see an end to the Israeli occupation of Palestine and the oppression of its people.
Now, for more insight into the life and times of Archbishop Tutu, we contacted Professor Farid Isaac, a Muslim scholar, writer, anti-apartheid activist, and a close friend of the late Archbishop Tutu. He's also a member of Africa for Palestine movement. Welcome to our program, sir. Now, what would you say is the main legacy of Archbishop Desmond Tutu in South Africa and the world in general?
Desmond Tutu's main legacy was his relentless struggle for justice. Desmond Tutu was harsh in his criticism of the oppressor and oppression. And it was his willingness to take a leadership role at great cost and to speak the truth to, earlier on, the apartheid regime, but later on in his iconic role as a supporter and defender of the oppressed throughout the world, particularly the Palestinian people. So that's his major legacy. The second part of his legacy, and I deliberately insist that it must be the second part, is his commitment to reconciliation.
Well, Professor Isaac mentioned there that Archbishop Tutu fully backed the struggle of the Palestinians against the Israeli regime.
In 2014, he joined thousands of people in Cape Town to protest against the Israeli regime's bombardment of Gaza. During the event, Tutu said the pursuit of the people of Palestine for freedom is a righteous cause.
The pursuit of the people of Palestine for freedom from humiliation, from persecution, from the unjust policies of Israel, that is something that is unstoppable, because it is a righteous cause. It is a righteous cause. It is God's own cause. For God created us for freedom.
Professor Isaacs, can you briefly elaborate on Archbishop Desmond Tutu's support for the Palestinian liberation and opposition to the Israeli regime?
Now, Desmond Tutu had been, as a religious leader, he had been to Palestine on a number of occasions. And from the first occasion that he went, he said that what he has experienced, and this is while he was there even, what he experienced in Palestine was not just akin or something like apartheid, in like South African apartheid, but that it was in fact in many ways much worse than what apartheid South Africa was. And he did not hesitate to call Israel an apartheid state, although of a worse kind than what South Africa was. Desmond Tutu had found Israel or Israeli society and the occupation of the Palestinian people far worse than what we as black South Africans had experienced under Israeli apartheid.
Now, Archbishop Tutu used his moral authority to speak out against atrocities perpetrated by the Israeli regime against Palestinians. Despite facing a backlash for his pro-Palestinian stance, he refused to back down and continued to support calls for the freedom of Palestine.
I am proud to support freedom for Palestine by One World. I urge everyone to buy the single and spread its message. Let's send a message to governments that a critical mass of people want to see an end to the Israeli occupation of Palestine and the oppression of its people. By acting together, we can break cycles of injustice and the occupation and build a new world based on our common humanity and justice. Support freedom for Palestine. Peace. Shalom. Salam.
Now, Professor, how can Desmond Tutu's legacy be kept alive regarding his support for the oppressed Palestinian nation?
I think that an escalation of the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement is one of the important ways in keeping his legacy alive. He was very explicit in his support for the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement. He described it as a non-violent movement, which indeed it is. However, Desmond Tutu, in the South African context, always indicated that it was the right of the oppressed people to decide on their means for liberation. And so a boycott of the Israeli state, a boycott of traveling to Israel, a boycott of buying and selling Israeli goods, the cutting off of diplomatic relations with Israel. And so the advancement of the boycott and sanctions movement, that will be a crucial way of retaining his legacy.
Tutu had put principle above political expediency in his outrage over the lack of prosecutions for those implicated in apartheid-era crimes. He warned that without reparations, through full confession or through prosecution, South Africans or any color or creed would not be able to heal from their traumatic past. Archbishop Tutu regretted that those who committed apartheid atrocities were not prosecuted and reparations were not paid to victims.
The one fascinating thing that he often addressed why in the South African case, when it comes to black people, are black people expected to forgive? When it comes to other people, and he referred very specifically to this, despite the fact that he was accused of being anti-Semitic, when it comes to the Jewish people, the world is quite happy for 92, 93-year-old people who were soldiers in the Nazi army, for them to continue to be searched for and to be prosecuted and to be sent to jail. So what's going on here? Is it that white people must be forgiven when they are criminals? And when black people were hurt, then you expect these black people to forgive?
The late Archbishop Tutu was also an environmental activist. He joined Call for Action on climate change and warnings about the future of humanity on planet Earth if no action is taken.
The whole world stands faced with a common threat of climate change. This global threat already affects us all, in particular the poorest and the most vulnerable. That alone should move all governments to act. But my heart is heavy when I imagine the devastation that will face our children and our children's children if we do not act now to stop it.
Now, regarding climate injustice, Archbishop Tutu also called for an apartheid-style boycott of corporations financing these injustices. Now, can you elaborate on this, Professor?
Archbishop Desmond Tutu was very comprehensive in his understanding of justice. In looking at climate change, the kind of demands that are being made on the global south, or the countries that are generally called underdeveloped, I would prefer the term global south, demands are made upon them when they are in fact the least contributors to carbon emission and therefore to the problem of global warming and climate change. And yet they are being asked to lower their emissions when countries in the global north deliver up to 50% more per individual than what countries in the global south does.
Well, there you have it. The late Archbishop Tutu was very comprehensive in his understanding of justice. May his soul rest in peace. Thanks a lot, Professor Isaac, for your insight. We now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall talk about the political crisis in Libya. So stay with us.
Libya elections crisis.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The Libyan presidential election was recently postponed, plunging the country into another political crisis. Now, the Libyan High National Election Commission announced that, despite being technically prepared, it was unable to meet the 24 December date set by the political roadmap for national elections.
citing inadequacies in electoral legislation and challenges and appeals related to the candidates' eligibility, the Commission requested that the Parliament set another date for the first round of the presidential election. However, Libya's Parliament refused to fix a date for presidential elections, leaving question marks about the fate of the poll. The Parliamentary Committee, charged with overseeing the election, presented a report saying it would be risky to set a new date at this stage.
A member of Libya's High Council of State said the postponement was not surprising at all.
"We were expecting that the elections weren't going to happen on December 24th, but now setting a new date will also be a contentious issue. From a legal standpoint, the Parliament must agree with the High Council of State on a new date. The question now is, how long will the postponement be for?"
Now, for more on the unfolding situation in Libya, we have contacted Mustafa Fituri, an independent Libyan academic and journalist. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us. Now, our first question to you, what are the real reasons behind the postponement of the presidential election in Libya?
The announced reason, or the official reason, if you like, is that there are some problems with the laws governing the presidential election, specifically law number 80, which was passed by the parliament last September. But the actual fact, the reasons behind this, two main reasons. One, there is foreign interest in the elections by certain countries, and they do not really want the elections to go ahead at this time. That's one thing. The second thing, which is also related to the first reason, is that there are Libyan factions, especially members of the High Council of State and their backers, foreign backers, who do not want the elections to take place.
"Everyone was waiting for these elections to save Libya. We want a president elected by the people to govern Libya, who would be recognized by all states in the world in order to get us out of this crisis. We don't know what's happening now, until when will the elections be postponed, after December 24, but until when? 1 week, two, a year? Nobody knows. On the whole, nothing is clear."
More than 2.8 million of Libya's 7 million residents had registered to vote in the postponed general elections. Many Libyans were disappointed by the postponement because they had registered to vote under the current circumstances. A voter in Libya speaks here in support of the elections before the postponement.
"I'm in favor of these elections. At least the situation will get better. We want our country to move forward."
How did most Libyans react to the postponement of the elections?
"Well, the reaction was very bad, very negative public reaction, a sense of discontent, a sense of anger and disappointment, and people are, you know, fed up. And when you look at the numbers, you know, the number of people who received their voting cards is something like 2.5 million people. And the people who registered to vote is something like 2.8 million people, a little bit more than that, actually, which reflects a huge interest, public interest, in the elections in Libya."
Foreign powers have backed various factions in Libya's complex conflict, and the presence of mercenaries and foreign troops is one of the toughest obstacles to a lasting peace. In 2021, the UN estimated that 20,000 foreign fighters were present in Libya. The United Nations Secretary General previously warned that foreign interference in the conflict in Libya has reached unprecedented levels.
"Time is not on our side in Libya. The conflict has entered a new phase, with foreign interference reaching unprecedented levels, including in the delivery of sophisticated equipment and the number of mercenaries involved in the fighting."
Now, you earlier mentioned about foreign interference in Libya's presidential election. Now, can you tell us which foreign actors are interfering in this country and what interests are they pursuing?
"I name a few: the United States for one, and the United Kingdom for two, and Turkey for three. Well, Turkey is not very, kind of astonishing anti-election position, but still prefers to have someone else other than those two guys, you know, which are poised, as I said, to win at least the first round of elections. And the second round, Mr. Gaddafi Jr. is expected to lead and probably win by something like 60 to 65% margin of the vote. And because of that, it's the foreign powers again that destroyed Libya in 2011. They are more or less the same who are involved in the election and pursue it to make sure that Libya comes out of this upcoming election, whenever it takes place, even in the future, and the way they wanted it to be. They want to reshape Libya differently from what it had been over the last 40 years of Gaddafi time. They just want to end the chaos, but in their own way.
Now, even before Libyan High National Elections Commission postponed the election in December, some Libyans had earlier called for the polls to be called off, saying the country lacks a comprehensive legal framework to hold elections. Now, our law professor explains here on why he opposed the elections at this juncture.
Without a constitutional foundation in any nation in the world, you cannot conduct a proper and neutral and just election. This is A, B, C, D. It is the very beginning lesson in democracy.
What's the way out of the current political crisis in Libya?
I am not with the idea of rush two elections. We are rushing two elections again, as we did in 2012 and 2014. It should have been at least another year before we have decided on this. But the problem with leaving the situation as it is now, the status quo as it is now, with those guys in power, especially in the parliament and the higher council of state in Tripoli, nothing will ever happen, even in 10 years' time. They just want to keep the status quo as it is because it benefits them.
The instability in Libya has made the country a favorite transit point for illegal immigrants who use the central Mediterranean route to enter Europe. According to the International Organization of Migration, there were more than 610,100 migrants in Libya in September 2021. 9 in 10 migrants left their country of origin primarily for economic reasons. The majority of the migrants were from neighboring countries, especially Niger, Egypt, Sudan, and Chad. With Libya facing a real risk of political instability, Europe must prepare for a new wave of migrants from the country and beyond.
Now, how is the political stalemate in Libya impacting on the country being used as a route by illegal migrants going to Europe?
The current crisis is actually having a certain impact on that. Why? You know, the security situation in the country, especially the Coast Guard and the policing and all this, has already been failing to contain the flow of people out of Libya towards Europe over the Mediterranean Sea, where most of them die, unfortunately. They are already failing. And when you have such a political crisis in the country, that means the institutions, which are already weak, and they are incapable of performing, they become weaker and even more failing to do their duty, which means they open the door for more increased number of migrants attempting to go to Europe, and that's what we have been seeing over the last 3-4 weeks.
Well, thank you very much, Mustafa Fetouri. We shall definitely keep an eye on Libya as the situation unfolds there. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. It was great having you, and goodbye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Democracy of religion from Imam Khomeini's point of view. We must be aware, our nation must be aware that when their gatherings are comprised of people from the middle class and in these gatherings there are no aristocrats and noblemen and monarchists and in government too, we don't have the type of governments in which affluent capitalist individuals and so forth are present. In the military too, we don't have the type of the generals and so forth who owned vast properties and multi-story apartment blocks, then the country is safe.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Today we are with another program of Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the search for Islam. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini has mentioned that just as we say with our tongues, our hearts should be convinced that we want Islam. Now here he is talking about the practical aspect of what we say. The sign of being a hypocrite is that what he says with the tongue, he does not have that in their hearts. And this is known as munafiq, like in the Arabic terminology or Persian terminology, they call it munafiq, or the hypocrites. The hypocrites, what they say, they don't do. Therefore, Imam Khomeini is saying that if you want to be a real mu'min, if you want to be a real believer, if you are a patriotic person, if you love your country, your state, if you love Islam, then the way you say with your tongue that we want Islam, we need Islam, we want to implement Islam, similarly, it should appear in your heart. Your hearts should say that. In other words, you should say this by your heart. You should feel it from inside, and then you must strive for such a thing. And if you do that, then Allah brings or puts barakah in your movement, then Allah accepts your movement.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi. Sallallahu alayhi.
Allah does not accept the prayers which we just say by tongue. Allah accepts those prayers which we really do by heart. If we ask for something by heart, Allah approves it. Allah gives us. This is the main thing in all activities, in all actions that we have, that if we say something by tongue and we do not believe in heart, these such things or such things do not have any effect on the public as well. Therefore, Imam Khomeini is saying that, oh people, the way you say with your tongue that you want Islam, you need to put this in your heart, and our hearts should be convinced that we want Islam. And this way, when Allah looks at our hearts, that in our hearts He finds nothing but Islam, He finds nothing but the love of Allah, then He brings blessings, then He bestows us with His best blessings and mercy, and there is the victory which comes from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, inshaAllah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Every night and every day.
Every night and